Well, we are here this morning on two rules petitions, but before we start, you'll notice the chair to my right, where Justice Ann Walsh Bradley generally sits, is not occupied. She is participating in these rules, but she's watching on Wisconsin Eye. She couldn't be with us today. So she's just participating in a little bit of a different way. Okay. We are starting with Rule Petition 1919, my agenda, and it looks like our Court Commissioner Mark Neisser is the presenter. Are you prepared to proceed, Counsel? Okay, please do.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Mark Neisser. As you know, I'm one of your commissioners, and I'm here today on behalf of the SAPAR's Appellate Practice Section Board to present Rule Petition 1919. The petition proposes a change 809.86, and the goal of this change is to clear the way for petitions for review responses to be made publicly available on the court's website while protecting crime victim privacy concerns. A real quick history lesson about 809.86, the rule that we're proposing to modify. 809.86 was adopted by this court in 2015. It requires that in, quote, appellate briefs, note the use of the word briefs, crime victims must be referred to by identifiers such as pseudonyms or initials. And the Judicial Council note that accompanies the rule explains that the rule's purpose is to protect the identity of victims in appellate briefs that are made available online. And here's the problem. 809.86, as currently drafted, only refers to appellate briefs. The crime victim privacy protections in that rule don't extend to petitions for review or responses to petitions for review. And as a result, those documents, petitions for review and responses, are not made available on the court's website. Court of Appeals briefs are available on the court's website. Supreme Court briefs are available on the court website. Petitions for review and responses, not. And that's a problem. As a State Bar Appellate Practice Section board member, other board members and State Bar members have come up to me and asked why this is. It would be nice to have petitions for review and responses available on the court website just as appellate briefing is, so that way the public can keep track of cases more carefully, and lawyers can actually look at the issues presented online so they know what issues are currently under consideration by the court, and in the past, what issues have worked to get review before the court. So that brings us to the point of this rule petition. Again, it's to fill this gap in 809.86 and clear the way for petitions and responses to be made on the court's website. That, making it available online on the court's website, is something that can be done as part of the court's appellate e-filing program, which is currently in the process of being rolled out. Judge Koshnick, who has oversight authority for the CCAP steering committee, has indicated that CCAP would certainly be willing to work on making petitions for review and responses available on the court's website. Those documents, by the way, petitions for review and responses, are already filed electronically, so it's just a matter of turning on public access on the court's website. And Jean Bisquette has also confirmed that from a technological standpoint, it should be a problem.
Was there ever an affirmative decision to not put...
No. In fact, if you look at 809.86 and you look at the Judicial Council note, it says, and again, this is dating back from 2015 when it was first passed, it says, the rule protects the identity of victims and appellate briefs that the courts make available online. This rule does not extend to other appellate filings, including appendices, because these documents are not currently posted electronically. To me, that sounds like 809.86 was just a first step. Let's get appellate briefing online first, and then we'll deal with petitions for review and responses later. That time is now. So the proposed amendment itself is actually very simple, couldn't be more simple. It's literally just adding the words petitions for review and responses to petitions for review in 809.86. The change shouldn't cause any heartburn for lawyers at all. They're already required to protect victims' identities in appellate briefing. So this is just saying you need to do what you've been doing all along in your appellate briefing. And as I mentioned earlier, petitions for review already have to be electronically filed. So this rule does not change that requirement at all.
And would it make it easier for the commissioners to get the petitions for review? Format.
Yes, it would.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In addition to that great point, there are no objections to this proposed rule change. As I noted in my supporting memo, I spoke with the clerk of courts and I spoke with the executive director of DOJ's Office of Crime Victim Services. Neither had any objection to the proposed rule change. The petition was put out for public comment. There was one received. It was from the Law Librarians Association of Wisconsin. They're supportive of the rule petition. So for all of these reasons, I'd urge you to adopt the petition. It's a straightforward fix. It is uncontested, and it will increase public access to filings in this court and still protect crime victim privacy interests. Mm-hmm. So with that closes my comments. I'd welcome any questions.
And this is the only impediment to them being electronic at this point.
Right. I mean, just to be clear, the rule change itself will not mandate that they become electronic. This is clearing the path, but it is the only impediment to them becoming publicly available. That's okay. Online.
And the court itself is moving into electronic format in total. So this is a step.
This
in
is
that
a
direction.
Necessary first step for that to happen.
Right.
Correct.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Are there any other speakers who would like to comment on Rule Petition 1919? Okay, seeing no one stepping up to the plate, then we will close the hearing on Rule Petition 1919 and move to Rule Petition 1916. Okay, Attorney Goldschmidt, please proceed.
May it please the court, good morning, Attorney James Goldschmidt for the petitioner, Quarles and Brady. With me are my colleagues, Lauren Zink and Sydney Vanberg, who provided very valuable assistance in drafting and researching the petition. It's an honor to be presenting to you this morning on this important topic. Thank you for hearing it. If I may, I'd like to reserve a few moments at the end for rebuttal.
Yeah, I generally give the presenter a chance to comment on all those folks in between the initial presentation at the end, so we'll certainly stick with that tradition.
Thank you. I'd like to begin then with an uncontroversial premise, which is that ghostwriting is good. Anonymous drafting assistance is one of the most helpful forms of limited scope representation. It allows otherwise unrepresented parties to complete legal papers in a way that complies with the rules and that courts and opposing parties better understand. This is not just a critical tool for closing the justice gap in Wisconsin, although it certainly is that. It is also immensely helpful to the courts. It streamlines legal proceedings. It promotes judicial efficiency. It also reduces burdens on courts and their staff. The court recognized all of these benefits in unanimously approving ghostwriting in 2014 as part of a larger package of rule changes designed to implement limited scope representation in Wisconsin. And with all of these benefits, one is left to wonder, why take this rule away? In fact, no one appears to have a problem with ghostwriting per se. But there is a stated concern with abuse of ghostwriting in the form of frivolous filings. This was the stated basis for the 2018 legislative amendment that brought the petition to you today, and it is also the reason that certain interests now apparently oppose changing the rule back. To be clear, there is no evidence of any judicial complaint anywhere in Wisconsin of frivolous ghostwriting since the rule was implemented in 2015 through 2018 when the rule went away. But if frivolousness is really the concern, I'd like to focus on that for a moment, because there are really much narrower ways to deal with that problem than to take the tool of ghostwriting away for the state. First of all, of course, courts already have the power to sanction frivolous filings. And in these limited scope cases, pro se parties are coming in with filings that they may have received help drafting, but they are ultimately responsible for the filing made to the court. And if a pro se party comes with a frivolous filing, the court can do something about that directly with the party. In addition, in many limited scope programs, including, ironically, the eviction defense program that brought this issue to the fore, volunteer attorneys work in the open. It's no secret who they are. If there's a problem with a filing, the judge in that court can deal with it by going to the program and speaking with a supervisor. And if the concern is that there's no way to discipline an attorney, if you don't know who they are, courts also have ways of finding these things out. I want to make sure to emphasize that we're not just talking about pro bono ghostwriting, but also ghostwriting for a fee. And in the case of ghostwriting for a fee, litigants are very likely to remember whom they paid to do the work for them in the event that there's a problem with the filing. The court can simply ask the party, whom did you pay to prepare this for you? Because it will, even under our proposed rule, say, prepared with the assistance of an attorney. In the case of pro bono work, litigants may not remember who helped them in a brief legal advice setting, but should at least remember when and where they received assistance, and the court, if necessary, can follow up from there. I take the time to address this issue not because there's any evidence that it was actually a problem, but because it was the stated basis for the rule change and because it is the stated basis for continuing to oppose our petition today. In all cases, in any event, it's critical to remember that those who would abuse ghostwriting already have significant incentives not to do so. Their license and the reputation of their firm or program is at stake. They're subject to relevant ethical rules, and relying on anonymity is a risky gamble.
Can you describe with any detail how a judge would be able to find out who the lawyer was that helped draft the document?
Yes, and I will again distinguish between for fee work and pro bono work, unless Your Honor would prefer to hear only about one.
No, both.
In the case of work for a fee, as I say, the client who comes in with the paper that indicates prepared with the assistance of an attorney will have paid some money to the attorney providing the representation. And so if there is not, at a minimum, a paper trail in the form of an invoice, at a minimum, the client should recall to whom they paid the money.
What about like a justice bus or something?
Right. So in the pro bono context, I think we would agree it's certainly more likely in those cases that clients may have a hard time remembering who provided the assistance. But I think the issue in those cases is not to penalize the pro bono client for their lack of recollection, which is what the proposed current amendment would do, but rather, at a minimum, those individuals should remember from where and when they received the assistance. I went to the justice bus. Okay. Now the court has the ability, if there really is an egregious situation, to call up that program and ask, you know, where were you? Who was working that day? If we really need to get to the bottom of who.
So that they keep records of who was working.
Yes. And those who speak today from the various pro bono programs around the state can provide perhaps more detail on those points. But ultimately, even if the end answer is, in that particular case, we can't track down that attorney, the vast benefits of ghostwriting, I think, still outweigh the inability to identify that attorney in that particular case because of all the good that this tool is doing around the state.
See, it's my recollection, at least in part, that some of these programs and some of these things had arisen prior to and some had arisen after. The court considered civil Gideon, for example, and that's come up a couple of times, but it seemed to be cost prohibitive, so lawyers found creative ways to say, wait, we can still help people in a pro bono way, but we need to be able to do it in a way that we can ethically perform our duties, and so limited scope and ghostwriting, a variety of different things were creatively thought of, and the court basically blessed them, right? I mean, at least passed the rules. So,
yes.
So it seems to me to unwind that, not to show my hand right away, but to unwind that would be going backwards in providing representation to people who need it most.
It certainly would. Ghostwriting is a very important tool in that toolbox of limited scope representation. And I will add that the court studied this in great detail before approving that package of rule changes in 2014. The PPAC subcommittee that presented the limited scope representation petition, 1310, had studied these issues for 3 years before bringing the petition. So it was a subject of extensive study. I think the problems with the current rule prohibiting ghostwriting are apparent and have been laid out in our papers, so I don't want to spend much time on that. I also think that we've spelled out the problems with the proposed amendment in the opposition comments, and that simply is not a workable rule for several reasons. I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on that either, except to say I understand that that bill has now made it into the legislature and is pending there, and I expect the court may have some questions about what to make of that and how to proceed.
I do.
Yes.
So I think everyone recognizes that this is an area of shared authority between the judiciary and the legislature. So let's say the court today or in the near future grants your petition, and we essentially override legislation enacted by the legislature. The legislature, in turn, could respond by saying, oh, yeah, well, we're going to reenact this legislation. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but who gets the final say?
So the accurate but not very satisfying answer is that whoever has the last word gets the last word. It's a last mover problem. It really can, based on our study of the case law, go back and forth. And the reason it doesn't is not because it's legally prohibited, but because of institutional considerations that, as a practical matter, mean one branch or the other stops acting. And in this case, I think it's important to note the legislator who introduced the 2018 amendment, Representative Brooks, has stated on the record in a committee hearing that he acknowledges the problems that bill caused and that he's simply looking for a solution. If this court acts today and provides that solution, we have every reason to believe that should be the end of the matter.
Can I ask you, along those regards, we got a letter from Representative Brooks.
Yes.
That was delivered to us today, and he said that he contacted you yesterday afternoon to discuss ways to make it more amenable. So I don't, not that I need a word for word of your discussion, but it's your understanding that he's not
yes.
looking to stop, I guess, is the nicest way to say it, what you're asking.
Right. He when we did speak yesterday afternoon, as he indicated, he made clear that he would not be appearing today to oppose the petition. And in fact, I would note on that point that no member of the legislature at any point has appeared in this proceeding to oppose what we're requesting. But we did discuss various ways that this could play out, and I asked him, if the court acts decisively today, will you live with that result? He said, well, some of my constituents may not be so happy with that outcome, but, you know, we will respect what the court does. Now, I don't think that necessarily means there might not be action on this at some point down the line. The legislature has the right to do that. And he also promised me that if that were to occur, we would be more involved in that process and have an opportunity to comment on the language. And I think they're really actually wide open on that, frankly, in the legislature, because they recognize, if I can be blunt, they stepped in it a bit here, and they want to fix the problem while at the same time mollifying all of their constituents. So that all of that is to say, if the court acts today, I have every confidence that the legislature will respect that, but they're not required to do that, and if there's further proceedings, we'll deal with that. I just think this is the same theoretical possibility that exists every time this court changes a rule, and it shouldn't be special here. It's just particularly focused or sharpened, perhaps, in this case. I would point, among other things, to the text of Statute 751.12, sub 2, where the language actually the text of the statute actually contemplates this possibility. So it says, all statutes related to pleading, practice, and procedure may be modified or suspended by rules promulgated under this section. What that says is, you know, a statute, something passed by the legislature, may be modified or suspended by a rule, something adopted by this court. So the text of the statute itself explicitly contemplates modification of statutes adopted by the legislature by this court.
What happens if there are potentially more than one aspect to a particular matter before us? So maybe something has a pleading and practice aspect to it, but maybe there's an additional aspect that would fall within the legislature's ambit, protection of the public, right? So if that is a possibility, perhaps we adopt the rule because we think, you know, this will streamline the practice of law, something over which we clearly have authority. But maybe the legislature looks at it and says, yes, that might make things more efficient for you, but there is a danger to the public, and we're going to protect against that. Shouldn't we defer to the legislature's decision in that regard?
Well, I'm not sure I would describe it as deference, but I think that certainly there is a give and take there between the branches that is necessarily the result of 751.12 sub 4 that preserves the legislature's right to act in these areas. Mm-hmm. If that had happened here, I would be more concerned about it. I think what we're talking about here is squarely a rule of civil procedure, and is limited to how attorneys represent their representation on papers filed with the court. In fact, if safety concerns are an issue, it would really be, in my mind, on the other side of the balance. If we're actually going to require, for example, in the family law context, attorneys who represent domestic abuse victims to be identified in court filings and online in CCAP, then that presents a serious risk of physical harm to those attorneys. And as we've seen some sad stories out of Wausau and elsewhere, attorneys who represent domestic abuse victims are threatened and harmed when they are identified in court filings. So these are the types of things that the court studied very carefully in adopting the rule initially. And in no disrespect for the legislature, I think it's fair to say it did not study these same issues in adopting the landlord bill that led to this change. I'm not sure if that completely answers your question, but if it doesn't, I'm sure you'll let me know.
So that's a very good start at the answer. But my concern is figuring out where the authoritative divide is between what we do and what the legislature does. And in my mind, it deals with the different aspects, potentially different aspects. Sometimes, you know, when we pass a rule, it's just a rule, and there's no, and it has no implications outside of the actual practice of law within our courts. Sometimes what we do could have broader implications. We might structure it as a pleading or practice matter, but it might have implications that go beyond that. And if the legislature responds to the implications that go beyond purely pleading in practice, then shouldn't it be our responsibility to say, well, that's within the legislature's domain to address, and we should respect that?
I don't think I disagree with that in the abstract. Mm-hmm. And I think it's inherent in the compromise nature of co-equal power for the court to be looking for those lines, just as the legislature mm-hmm. should be looking for them. I just don't think that this particular rule presents those concerns. So I understand perhaps a temptation now that the legislature has gotten the ball rolling to say, for example, let's see how that plays out, and rather than take action today. But I would like to emphasize that we came to the court because from every conceivable angle, it is best situated to understand this problem and address it.
Do you think that litigants who are adverse to litigants who receive this ghostwriting pro bono service, do you think that the people or businesses on the other side of those cases have any interest in knowing which attorneys provided assistance to the otherwise pro se litigant?
Well, I think the facts as they have played out demonstrate that they do have an interest in knowing that. I don't think they have any right to know that, unless, again, the pleading is frivolous or otherwise objectionable in the court's view, at which point action can be taken. But this court concluded in adopting the ghostwriting rule initially that that was where it would draw the line. We were going to tell parties this was prepared with the assistance of an attorney, but you don't need to know who that is.
The reason I'm asking the question is because in reading all of these materials, it appears that there has been an exodus of attorneys who were providing this pro bono assistance because they're worried about conflicts, right? And it appears there are some firms that are not allowing their attorneys to provide this assistance because they're worried about conflicts. So what I'm wondering specifically is, I'll give you an example. You're from Quarles and Brady, right? So let's say Quarles and Brady has attorneys who represent landlords. And Quarles and Brady also has some attorneys who are providing pro bono assistance to tenants. Would your clients, who are landlords, have a legitimate and real interest in knowing that Quarles and Brady is kind of also representing on the other side of this issue, or even representing tenants directly adverse to the landlord that your firm represents?
Absolutely, they would want to know that. And the ethical rule that comes into play here in terms of conflicts is special in the context of limited scope representation. In limited scope representation, the ethical rule requires you to withdraw from a representation only if there is a known conflict, meaning you show up at the clinic, you see you're adverse to X landlord client, and you know that's a client of your firm. If there is not a known conflict, then you're not required to withdraw. And so while your other client may have a business interest in knowing that information, they would not have an ethical complaint against you for continuing in the pro bono representation.
So I assume, but I don't want to assume anything, that the firms are running these matters through their conflicts system to avoid those types of conflicts, aren't they?
They are not. So they are sending volunteer attorneys to clinics run by third parties, and in the fast pace of those clinics, it's not usually possible to run conflicts checks back at the firm for everyone who's coming through the door. As a result of all this, the question becomes, in that case, do we want to have that happen, which would be a whole different set of rules around limited scope representation, or do we want to say we're not going to worry about that in that context because we want these people to be getting brief legal advice, and if you're not actually appearing in court to represent someone adverse to your own client, then we're going to say that's all right.
Theoretically, that could happen. You could have an attorney learning information adverse to their own client, right?
Theoretically, that could happen, and that is a feature of the limited scope regime as it exists in Wisconsin, which we're not challenging today. The only question today is whether these attorneys should be required to identify themselves in addition to identifying that this document was prepared with the assistance of an attorney. I agree, it's an uncomfortable issue, perhaps, from an ethical perspective, but again, with the focus and limited scope representation being on known conflicts, the only time that attorney would actually be ethically required to withdraw would be if they walk in and see someone they know as a client on the other side.
And I wasn't on the, just one more, I wasn't on the court in 2014, and I know that there was extensive study done to support the petition or perhaps to oppose it if there was opposition back then, but I don't know to what extent this particular issue was examined. I would think it would have been, but any history there that you can share with me about perhaps the balancing that went into the decision ultimately to accept ghostwriting and allow it in Wisconsin? That's a broad question. Maybe there's other speakers who are, and I'm giving you an out here, if there's other speakers who could particularly address that, who might have that history.
Yes. So I will say, in focusing on the petition 1310 that allowed limited scope representation, there was a great deal of discussion about the whole package that included ghostwriting. And ghostwriting at the time was viewed as an essential tool because in a lot of cases, there's a correlation between the attorney's fee and their appearance for the party. So an attorney who is going to appear for a party, sign up as their representative in this court matter, proceed through the whole matter and so forth, is going to demand a much higher fee for doing all of that and being on the hook for the matter with the court. Removing that piece of the representation, in other words, saying, I'm not appearing for you, I'm not on the hook with the court, I'm just helping you draft this document, was seen as a way to reduce the amount of money lawyers were willing to accept to provide services and thereby bring legal services to a greater segment of the population.
So with regard to the, since the bill passed, and now the bill requires attorneys to disclose their name, has there been the conflict checks now that's been run through? There still isn't, correct? Because limited representation is still in its own area.
Right. The change in the rule has not changed any of the ethical or conflicts check aspects of limited scope representation.
All it's done is really reduce the ability for people who can't afford attorneys to have limited representation in filling out a document or doing some of those initial steps.
Right, and I will note specifically on the problem of frivolous pleading that led to this change to begin with, the change in the rule doesn't solve that problem. Because if I put my name on a document that I've prepared in a brief legal advice setting, and then my 20-minute client takes it away, they can do whatever they want with it after that before filing it with the court, which may well be where some of these frivolous matters can slip in. So not only does it not solve the problem, but now I'm on the hook for a pleading that someone else has tampered with and isn't even my work.
Well, isn't, now that you raise that, that is a very good point, because you are engaged in limited scope representation by giving your name but not being responsible for the ultimate case. You have no control because it's the client who's pro se. So they could, in fact, change every single thing you did, and now you're supposed to appear before potentially us on some kind of ethics violation.
Right.
So this causes a significant problem for attorneys to even engage in this kind of representation at all.
Right. So attorneys look at that prospect and say, no thanks. If that's what I'm going to have to do, then I'm just not going to do it. And maybe I'll provide some other type of pro bono help, but I'm not going to provide the help that allows forms to be drafted in ways that courts can understand. That's a problem. I think I'll reserve any remaining points for closing unless anyone else has questions for me now.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Dean Dietrich, looks like you're the first one on my hit parade here.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Dean Dietrich. I'm an attorney in Wausau. and I appear before you today as representative of the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I apologize for my voice. I have a cold. I've been struggling with it for 3 weeks now, and I have a cough drop in there trying to help me.
Me too, and I hope mine doesn't last 3 weeks.
Well, it's been a long time. I would like to first of all reiterate the simple policy statement that I provided to you in my correspondence. This was adopted by the Board of Governors of the State Bar and speaks to the encouragement of the use of ghostwriting as part of the vital process we could use to assist in providing legal services under various umbrellas. The issue before you, in the form of the, some would say, reinstatement of the rule as originally proposed and accepted by the court, can be looked at through various lenses. And the lens that I look at it through speaks or goes to the points that have been raised regarding conflicts of interest. I work very hard to deal and to help lawyers understand issues of conflicts of interest in their representation. And I think the writings that you've received from many different sources have shown the tremendous concern that lawyers have about being involved in this limited scope representation, principally through a clinic, and having now stopped doing that because of concerns about conflicts of interest and concerns about involvement in a proceeding. It would be clearly my advice to any lawyer, even in a pro bono clinic setting, that is putting their name on a document, that that be run through their conflicts checking system. Because whether they even are involved from a limited scope, and counsel has described the intent of limited scope representation, the fact that you're now named on a document, to me, makes it much more necessary for you to run a conflicts check. It is very important for lawyers to be concerned about conflicts in the representation. There's a business component to conflicts, but there's very much an ethical component to conflicts. So I think that the rule as originally approved by this court addresses that and helps lawyers continue to provide representation in these settings without creating a significant problem as it relates to conflicts of interest. I realize this court is also concerned and struggling with the issue of whether this particular matter belongs under the jurisdiction of this court or belongs under the jurisdiction of the legislature, or maybe both. And I suspect that issue will not reach a penultimate conclusion as we debate this particular rule. But there are two points I would make, again, from my vision, my view, my lenses that I look at. Number one, this rule specifically, clearly relates to conduct of the lawyer in requiring or not requiring the lawyer's name be on that pleading, that brief, that document. Conduct of the lawyer, which is clearly within the scope and jurisdiction of this court. Again, from my lens, this also relates to the relationship between the lawyer and the client, a topic of conflicts, a topic of conduct of the lawyer. Conflicts of interest, ethical duties under the rules of professional conduct are not in the ballpark of the legislature. They're in this court. They're in this jurisdiction. So from my perspective, I believe that the issue before this court soundly belongs before the court, soundly belongs within the jurisdiction of the court, and needs to be addressed for me to make sure that we have conflicts addressed, for the court in, as well, to make sure that we're doing everything possible to ensure that legal services are being provided in every possible way. So I offer those additional comments to the policy statement of the Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors would ask this court to approve this petition.
Do you think we should just disregard the interests of an adverse party in knowing who has performed legal work for the otherwise pro se litigant on the other side?
The first, I will comment that the proposed amendments to the current statute would which are designed to address that, if somebody wants to know, would create a tremendous burden on the court personnel at all levels. So I think that that does not assist the parties. The question that you pose requires a balancing. It requires a balancing of the relationship between the limited scope lawyer and pro bono services, perhaps, and the client and the party on the other side. The matter is between the two parties. The matter is where the party should be concerned. Opposing party in a matter doesn't really have an interest in who's assisting the party on the other side. That relationship between who's assisting, an attorney-client relationship, if there is one, is really what this rule should address and should be concerned about. The party on the other side should be in a position to be arguing about, concerned about, and addressing the merits of the case and the arguments being presented by the other side, not who they have assisting them.
Well, you could say that about any case, really, but we do have conflicts rules and ethics rules that govern conflicts of interest of attorneys, and for a reason.
Yes, but the conflicts of interest rules addresses that relationship between that party and the attorney, the person that they're assisting. Where I see this come up, and often kind of an interesting, creates an interesting debate, is there's an attorney-client relationship between the party on the case and the attorney. And the party on the other side of the case and the attorney for the other side of the case moves to disqualify the lawyer because of some relationship between the lawyer and what the lawyer has done and his or her client. That other party doesn't have grounds to move to disqualify the attorney who's representing the other side. That's a matter of the attorney and the client on that side. And we often see people saying, well, we're going to disqualify when it has nothing to do with their relationship. So, again, to the extent to which the other side deserves to know who's assisting the party, what the other side deserves to know and should work on is, what are the arguments, what are the legal issues, and what's my position?
Any other questions for Attorney Dietrich? Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down and participating. The next person I have is Attorney Giese.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you on this matter. My name is Heinrich Giese. I'm an attorney in Milwaukee. Represent the Apartment Association of Southeastern Wisconsin and have been heavily involved in landlord-tenant issues in particular.
Could I stop you just a minute?
Sure.
We are having a little trouble with our sound. Yeah, you're a little bit taller.
Try to get that. So. Oh, sure. There we go.
That's okay. Much better. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Thank you.
Even though I live in Milwaukee, like Attorney Dietrich, I was once in Wausau as a young boy living on a farm in Marathon County. That's relevant to this proceeding in so far as I witnessed sausage making as a boy on the farm where we made our own sausage. One of the witnesses on AB 705, which is the bill that seeks to remedy the problem that's arisen here, referenced sausage making, and I'm sure we've all heard that that is akin to or the problems in the legislation. So with that in mind, I would point out that there clearly is a problem here that has to be fixed. The way this was changed, if it isn't changed, for example, someone coming into a legal clinic wanting to have a petition for probate administration drafted, right now the law would require that the volunteer would have to put their name on that document, and that really wouldn't be necessary. There's a lot of probably uncontested kind of things that people seek legal advice for, and in those situations, the attorney should not have to put his or her name on the document. But we've tried to fix this by, when I say we, people that have worked on this, by requiring that if there's some kind of a contest or some contested matter, that then the attorney's name should be revealed. I worked extensively with judges Dwyer and Gramling James Gramling in Milwaukee, and I came up with some ideas. Ultimately, those weren't accepted by the people on the other side. Unfortunately, I'm very glad to hear that they're perhaps now willing to work with Attorney Brooks if there's something on the legislative end that needs to be done, because that is certainly one way this can be solved. Of course, it also can be solved through the court. I agree that I think both court and legislature have joint authority in the case. It should be noted that the real problem here is if you look at this doesn't really totally eliminate or totally destroy pro bono volunteerism or ghostwriting. I think we have to remember in 802.05, there is the last part of that statute says that the attorney who's going to remain anonymous has to perform an independent reasonable inquiry as to the merits of some pro se self-represented person as to what they're trying to prove. And if it's a contested matter and you don't have the attorney's name on that document, then how can you ever establish whether or not that person did in fact make an independent reasonable question or inquiry as to whether what the merits are of that individual?
I read your letter and I thought it was very well done, but I'm not sure that I understand what you think your interest is in knowing the name of the person who represented an opposing party just by drafting some documents. Can you maybe focus on that a little bit?
Well, interestingly, Chief Justice, I included in my papers a particular case that I was aware of and was involved in, the Wisniewski case, all claims eviction case. In that case, that attorney drafted an answer and, in fact, a counterclaim in a commercial eviction for a pro se litigant.
Right.
And my belief is that there was one defense which asserted that service of the notice had been improper. That defense, from my knowledge of the case, was unsubstantiated. And so as defense counsel, in a case like that, you'd like to know, well, who raised this defense? Why did they raise it? And I think you'd be entitled to know who that attorney was.
So,
so you thought the defense was frivolous? Is that your position?
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, your court is always available to you to make that kind of a motion in regard to pleadings that are filed before you. Was there any motion like that made, you know, by the people involved?
No. The case was then resolved when the tenant failed to show up, and ultimately a default judgment was entered.
Okay.
So, yeah. So typically in a lot of these small cases, you're not going to have any kind of further appearance, I would say.
So presumably in that kind of case, you would want a second hearing where the lawyer comes in and testifies, whether that's the document they drafted or not, or whether the client pursued that on their own, or whether the client gave the lawyer the information to make the lawyer believe that wasn't frivolous. What would that look like to you?
Well, Justice Ziegler, I think it's actually more subtle than that. I don't think the scenario you describe is actually going to arise much. What the real intent here is, as the lawyer is sitting down with the with the litigant, and let's take this eviction case as an example, the fact that when they are going to interpose some defenses or do a counterclaim, the fact that they have to put their name on that document, not as their attorney for the person, that's clear they're not their attorney, they're just giving them advice and saying, I give this advice, that is an incentive to them to be meticulous, to follow the rule about an independent, reasonable inquiry, and not to simply say, yeah, service of process defense, or you said you didn't get the notice. Yeah, I sort of think you did get the notice on the right date. We'll put that in there, which is what prompted this whole litigation in the first place, because there was a pattern in eviction cases where there was a 32-page check-the-box kind of document that attorneys for tenants were using. Okay, you've got this defense. Oh, maybe you've got that defense also. Let's just throw in some extra defenses here. And we found that objectionable, which led to the present litigation.
Mm-hmm. I just need to get this straight in my mind. So let's just assume they're sitting across the table from each other and the client says, no, I get that piece of paper. The lawyer should do what? The lawyer should not check the notice box. The lawyer should do further investigation. The lawyer should assume the client's telling them the right information. What should the lawyer do to preserve possible defenses for someone they're going to see once or
a short
period of time?
The lawyer should certainly investigate and submit or write up any valid legal defenses. That's certainly true.
Investigate? Rightly or wrongly, that a lot of times a bus pulls in and opens the doors and people walk in and documents are drafted based upon conversations and then they say goodbye and the people go on their way. So what's a lawyer supposed to do when someone says, hey, yeah, no, I didn't get that piece of paper, or it didn't quite seem right to me, or what? Small claims is really kind of, having had a lot of small claims cases too, crazy things happen in small claims. People say and assert all sorts of defenses. Sometimes those are the toughest cases to try as a judge, because you're sitting there trying to dot the I's and cross the T's on every possible thing that might have been raised. They're actually more complex sometimes than civil matters. So what's a lawyer do in that scenario? Because I would think they see a lot of those.
Well, that's true. And they've got to assert any reasonable defense. There's certainly no doubt of that. But it could perhaps be boiled down to this keeps them honest. What's wrong with, and especially, as I said, if it's a pleading, if it's not just some probate some routine thing, if it's asserting a defense, if it's asserting a counterclaim, what's wrong with requiring the attorney to put their name on that document?
So we give an oath. You took it, I took it. When we become an attorney, we're about to give it again next week. Other than the case that you're talking about where this claim was in your mind frivolous, or was in fact frivolous, let's just say that, do you have any support for what your really telling us, which is that attorneys that represent pro se individuals are less likely to uphold their oath as attorneys, to not outwardly lie and outwardly make stuff up. I mean, is there any proof to that?
Well, unfortunately, I wish I had that 32 check-the-box thing document here. As I recall, there was actually one defense on that document that had been overturned by a statute and was still on the check-the-box form, which we noticed that we thought, well, what is this? These volunteer attorneys are going to check a box, possibly thinking it's a good defense, when it's not.
So that's something you could take to, like, the forms committee to change the form.
Sure. Right. I'm explaining that's why this was passed.
Okay. Yeah, oh, no, yeah, well, yeah, sure. There's other ways to do that besides all the other complications that I'm sure even more people will talk about with putting the name on the form, right?
True.
Maybe right, if you see a problem, you could take it to the forms committee and try to remedy it that way.
Of course, certainly. That's another.
How do we even know the lawyer checked that box?
Well, that leads to an interesting interesting aspect, the idea that people are going to change something that the lawyer did when they go. This has been mentioned by Mr. Goldschmidt. I think some other speakers are going to claim that. I just don't think that's a very realistic chance at all of that happening. People
but
are
wouldn't
going
you
to
have to at least have a second hearing where you come in and the lawyer says, I mean, the lawyer would then have to probably keep records of what the document looked like the moment the person left, but I would think that would be an important inquiry before you say someone acted unethically or improperly.
Yeah, I know. We're not, the just check the box thing isn't being used anyway, so that problem is solved, I think.
Okay.
But that's where I don't understand, though, that objection, because if it's, again, take that Wisniewski case, I mean, here's a nicely drafted answer and counterclaim. The idea that the pro se person is then going to take that nicely drafted lawyer thing and say, oh, gee, you know, I think I'll cross out this word. What are they going to do, add a paragraph in handwriting or something? Are they going to run it through their word processing at home and come up with a totally different document than what the lawyer drafted? I just don't think that's realistic at all, that that's going to happen. So,
do the members of your association that you represent have any concern about what I voiced earlier, which is, do they have an interest in knowing what attorneys may have helped somebody on the other side to ensure that they're not hiring that firm or those attorneys to represent it? Is there a conflict of interest issue from your perspective?
There is absolutely a conflict of interest issue there, and that is a difficult problem to resolve. We're not against, certainly pro bono help. The pro bono attorneys, by the way, who work on the eviction defense project, a lot of times they do good. There's sometimes when it doesn't work out that well, and it's adversarial to landlords, but it does work out good generally. But if I go to Mr. Goldschmidt's office and tell him that my landlord is evicting me and I'd like to have him help me, he certainly is going to run a conflicts check at Quarles and Brady to see whether or not, you know, they represent that landlord. If it's a large landlord with some hundreds of units, maybe that landlord has some kind of a refinancing project underway currently, which they're involved in. So if you think about it, how is it really different if I go into the legal clinic and Mr. Goldschmidt's a volunteer that day, and I say, here, I'm being evicted. Please, can you look at this, and can you help me? Seems to me he's really got the same duty. I don't know how you really get around that.
Well, then pretty much everybody in a big firm can't do it, and pretty much anybody who thinks they might have that kind of client in a small firm can't do it.
Right. Theoretically, it does. Well, unless you run the conflict thing. Yeah. One other. Interestingly, in the legal clinic setting, especially with again the eviction defense project, which I'm most familiar with, I think one answer there is if the attorney gives advice and does some drafting, is that can then be submitted under the auspices of the lead attorney in that project, or the clinic director, so that the attorney who's actually looked at it and given legal advice doesn't have to put his or her name on it. That would be one way to solve that.
All right.
So right now, interestingly, Justices, there's for all the brouhaha that's arisen here, this law is the strict application of the law is actually being ignored to a large extent in Milwaukee County with the Eviction Defense Project in the following fashion. A large part, and I monitor this quite a bit for my association, a large part of what the eviction defense attorneys do is they work on stipulations with landlords and tenants. They talk to the landlord's attorney, they reach an agreement, tenant will move out by a certain date, tenant will pay the past rent, and they're allowed to stay, and then a stipulation is signed. That is not signed by the attorney. That is signed by the landlord's attorney, and it's signed by the tenant. The volunteer does not put their name on that document, and there are very many of those documents handled every day. And we really have no problem with that. Those are not contested cases. That's a stipulation that's being solved. And
well, it's contested till it's not.
Well, yes, it is. But I mean, it's sure. But I mean, at that point, when the attorney is involved and the stipulation is agreed to, then it's no longer contested. It's done at that point. So we would have no problem with the change that we proposed, which would allow that to go forward without the attorney's name on it.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to appear, and thank you for your letter. It was very helpful. The next person I have on my list is Attorney Piper Brown.
I think I'm going to have the opposite microphone problem. Can you see me?
Yeah. You know, we can't do anything with our podium or not a lot with our mic either, so it's kind of hard for you to talk into it. I don't know if it could go further down and stay further. But.
All right. Good morning, and thank you for having us here today. My name is Maggie Niebler Brown. Since 2014, I have been the director of the Volunteer Lawyers Project at Legal Action of Wisconsin. And so I oversee a firm-wide pro bono programming at Legal Action. I am here to support the Rural Petition 1916 because I have seen how Wisconsin Statute Section 802.052M has created confusion and reduced the breadth of services pro bono attorneys provide in pro bono programs. I believe the Rural Petition 1916 would encourage pro bono participation and greatly benefit pro se litigants' access to the courts. As you know, Legal Action is the largest civil legal aid provider in the state. Our service area covers 39 southern counties, which includes both urban and rural parts of Wisconsin. In Legal Action's service area, the 2019 poverty population was estimated to be 4,991,562 people. Throughout our service area, attorneys at Legal Action actively participate in local and state bar committees, bench bar meetings, legal access committees, and the Access to Justice Commission. I work closely with other large pro bono providers, such as the Marquette Volunteer Legal Clinic, the Milwaukee Justice Center, and the State Bar of Wisconsin, to coordinate services. If any courts had concerns about documents drafted in compliance with the Supreme Court rule, the ghostwriting rule, where the name was not on the documents, I believe that Legal Action and the other large pro bono providers would have been notified. However, I do not know of a single court complaint regarding ghostwritten documents. I know there's been a lot of questions about program accountability, and it has not come back to the programs as a problem that there's concerns on documents drafted at our clinics. After the Wisconsin statute went into effect in 2018, I have seen a decrease in willingness to provide more than advice to pro se litigants because attorneys are now required to put their name and bar number on documents they draft, even when they are not entering their appearance. I have seen attorneys at clinics and ethics CLEs on limited scope representation identify the potential challenges that my colleague Elizabeth Greschel is going to outline in detail. And for this reason, many decide to opt out of drafting documents. It is easy to understand why a private attorney would decide to opt out and wouldn't want to be pulled into cases that they did not file. We've discussed this already today. This results in pro se litigants leaving pro bono clinics less prepared to navigate the court process alone. They are not receiving the benefits this court intended when passing the ghostwriting rule.
I just had a quick question.
Sure.
Do you have the people who come in and seek help, do you have enough lawyers who are coming in now? Or I mean, can you quantify any of this problem in any way? Not that you have to, but if you have any ballpark, just curious. Ballpark in terms of the reduction of lawyers. You know, there's been a representation that we have fewer and fewer people willing to volunteer. Can you give us any tangible sense of the scope of that problem?
Because of the nature of a lot of legal actions programs, I don't know that it's reduced the people coming in to volunteer, but it's reduced the services that they're willing to provide while they're volunteering. So they would stop at advice where prior to the 2018 statute, they were actually drafting documents. I do think that it has impacted participation in some of the other programs, and some of them are going to talk today. So I haven't seen a reduction in participation. I've seen a reduction in the type of service that's being provided to people that are going to, we know, are leaving the clinic going to be pro se litigants. So as I talked about this great need for civil legal aid and this demand to always have more representation, legal aid staff attorneys are not ever going to be able to meet that need, and we do rely on these pro bono attorneys greatly. Even with the private bar's help, legal action turns away over 10,000 people. Okay. These realities were studied and carefully considered by this court when issuing a series of rules that clarified and expanded liminal scope in 2014. These changes successfully encouraged pro bono. After the rule change, legal action developed several limited scope projects, including Lawyer for a Day projects, the Eviction Defense Project in Milwaukee and Dane County, the Truancy Court Project in Appleton Area School Districts, a Domestic Abuse Injunction Project in Milwaukee. We've also developed robust limited scope expungement clinics, driver license recovery clinics, and bankruptcy clinics, all designed to help low-income residents expand their employment opportunities. Attorneys are attracted to these limited scope opportunities, and hundreds of low-income clients have received assistance from these pro bono programs. With the protection afforded by the Supreme Court rules, there was an increase of projects, and advice clinics began providing greater level of service, both at legal action and through other pro bono providers, including drafting pleadings for clients who would have pursued the pro se otherwise. When we are unable to provide representation, legal action frequently directs clients to other pro bono legal providers who are well-positioned to assist pro se litigants. So when we turn people away, we are directing them to clinics that are designed to help pro se litigants and best positioned for that, such as the Milwaukee Justice Center and the Marquette Volunteer Legal Clinics. For example, every day we redirect the majority of requests for family law assistance to these pro bono clinics. When I do this, I hope that they meet with an attorney willing to prepare the necessary documents, because I know this can critically impact the pro se litigant's ability to put forward their case for child placement, maintenance, and rights to property. When it is clear that a litigant is going to have to proceed pro se while you're at the clinic, attorney's ability to prepare the pleadings changes both their volunteer opportunity and better positions the client. It expands the client's access to the court for the pro se litigants. The filings are more prepared. They're more likely to not give up. If they're just given advice, this is what you need to do to proceed on your case, they might be overwhelmed with just the process of preparing documents. They're also less likely to face problems in submitting an application or a submission to the court or a filing, because it's going to be more properly designed, and they're going to follow the procedures necessary. It's also useful to the courts. James discussed that earlier today. And it encourages pro bono, which I think is one of the main things that the limited scope package intended to do in 2014. Attorneys want to be helpful, and they want to use their skills when they're volunteering. So if they are able to better position a client that they meet at a clinic, and let that person leave with documents that are well prepared, they have relevant arguments. The arguments are based in both, you know, with a background of civil procedure and evidentiary rules and all of the things that we as attorneys understand but might be overwhelming to a pro se litigant, they're going to feel more useful, and it's going to encourage them to want to volunteer more often because they can really see the value that their volunteering, even in a limited scope capacity, is giving to the community. So for these reasons, I ask that we do support this rural petition today. So,
good.
And I'm happy to answer any questions about pro bono programming. It sounded like there were questions on how the programs do actually coordinate some of these issues. No?
Thank you.
Okay.
Attorney Greschel?
Yes, thank you.
Ah, you're here and I'm looking at my list. Well, good for you.
Hello.
Okay. Good morning.
Chief Justice and members of the court, thank you for having me here today. My name is Elizabeth Greschel. I have been a proud legal aid attorney at Legal Action of Wisconsin in Oshkosh since 2015. My practice spans 10 counties, including those surrounding the Fox Valley and beyond. I speak today in strong support of Rural Petition 1916. Because Wisconsin Statute Section 802.05-2M is detrimental to my work and the lives of so many low-income individuals who I serve. I'm one of two attorneys who cover housing in the 10 counties I practice in, and the only attorney to cover public benefits and driver's license recovery. The service my colleagues and I provide can be life-altering for our clients. This is especially true in our offices that serve rural areas. In Adams County, for example, there is no pro bono opportunities except contacting our office if they can get an appointment. Usually, even if a client has other low-cost or free options, legal action attorneys are experts in our area. They will not receive better advice or information about landlord-tenant matters from anyone else other than our office. In a landlord-tenant case, whether I choose to represent someone in court will likely impact whether they have housing. But I cannot take every case. So more often than I like, I must admit my services to providing forms or drafted pleadings for pro se parties. I learned it as a habit from other colleagues in my office to put my name on pro se documents. I saw my name on pro se pleadings as a source of pride and publication of my work. Even if I could not represent a pro se party in court, a court commissioner or a judge could see Legal Action's name and know that we exist. I did not question the practice until I received a voicemail from a court commissioner about a pro se document with my name on it. The court commissioner wanted a provision redrafted, and she wanted me to do it rather than the pro se tenant or pro se landlord. I dropped all other work to discuss this with other attorneys in my office. In the end, I contacted the pro se tenant, and we decided I would redraft it. I want to note that we heard today about Attorney Giese discussing the idea of names only in contested matters, and I can tell you affirmatively that in the four cases every week I'm turning away, they'll still be going to court and contesting the matter, and my name would need to be provided because, as we'll talk about in a second, at this point I am still providing my name on documents when I'm providing the documents. So that would mean that the court would have my name, not as representing attorney, but somewhere in CCAP, in all of these cases that I'm turning away on a weekly basis. That experience chilled all advice-only practices within our office. I could not afford to risk receiving more calls from courts. Admittedly, within our office, if anyone is to provide pro se documents, it's me. I'm the one who can't say no. But after that call, for a few months, even I wouldn't provide those documents to people. But I grew tired of it, as I just said. So I started providing pro se pleadings again with my information. This has still led to occasional issues, like court clerks calling me and asking where I am, because since my name's on the pleading, obviously I'd be attending court. And you can imagine this comes from a conversation in court and why I'm not there, where they say to the pro se party, they're providing their documents, and they say, ma'am, do you have an attorney? And they're in a state of crisis when we're talking about landlord-tenant issues. They're about to be homeless. So they say, I don't know. I went into this place called Legal Action. They gave me this form. She might be here today. I don't know. I hope so. And in order to ensure that there's no issue, that I didn't just miss the hearing, the court will call. I witnessed one of these conversations between a pro se party and the court while I waited for a hearing where I was actually the attorney of record. Our clients are desperate. They need all the legal assistance they can receive, even if it's only a pro se form that I help them complete. There was one other thing I wanted to note, which was I am very meticulous with what I do and my work. Either my client has a defense or they don't. Whether it's strong is something we discuss while we're working on the form. So as far as if they have a service defense, I may say, well, you know, it sounds like something you might not be able to prove. I don't know that I would even raise this as an attorney, but if you're telling me this, you can make this answer, but a court's probably not going to believe you. So the suggestion, these ethical considerations, I want you to know that I am making those considerations. I am having those hard conversations, telling people, I hear what you're saying, but you're probably going to be homeless. A judge isn't going to believe what you're saying. And all I can do is give them this form and wish them luck in those cases where I'm not providing representation. So I strongly urge this court to impose the proposed statutory amendment to Wisconsin Statute 802.052M. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for coming to participate. Attorney Ramos, and you too are right up there. Okay.
Thank you, Chief Justice and other members of the court, for giving us the opportunity to comment on this. And thank you also to Quarles and Brady for bringing this petition to your attention so we can talk about these important issues. My name is Rafael Ramos, and I'm an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, and I also serve as the director of the Eviction Defense Project, a project that's been at the center of so much discussion today. I'm here today to obviously speak in favor of the petition and to discuss barriers to access to justice created by this, the changes to the statute, and also to provide some background to the court regarding the processes of the Eviction Defense Project and how we work to address some of the accountability issues that have been raised. As others have said, Legal Action of Wisconsin is the largest civil legal aid provider in the state. We do that through direct representation and also through work with the private bar by providing case referrals and pro bono cases, and also the establishment of legal clinics like the Eviction Defense Project. What's underscored in all of that is that the use of pro bono attorneys to serve our clients is essential to access to justice. There simply are not enough civil legal aid providers who do not charge fees to provide assistance to people who do not have the resources to hire an attorney. And when this court unanimously adopted the rules expanding limited scope representation in 2014, the State Bar's Wisbar News noted that the purpose was to give people greater access to discrete legal services at costs much lower than a full representation might entail. With the increasing number of pro se litigants, allowing limited scope representation has been a priority in many states. And what we have seen is that the elimination of ghostwriting has undermined that purpose. It has made it more challenging for attorneys to provide limited scope representation, and it has discouraged them from participating in pro bono opportunities. Now, because the Eviction Defense Project, the EDP, has been the center of so much discussion, because it was the impetus for the elimination of ghostwriting, I wanted to provide some information to the court as to the nature of the project and the work we do to clear up some misconceptions about our work. The Eviction Defense Project was launched in 2017, January of 2017. 2016 was the last year before our project, and in 2016 there were 13,457 eviction cases filed in Milwaukee County. In those thousands of cases, tenants had representation in 112, less than 1% of cases. Since our launch, our clinic uses pro bono volunteers to provide limited scope representation to tenants, very often the day they have court. And through our representation, we've increased the representation rate of tenants by over 600%. So we've achieved the goals of the court when they expanded limited scope representation. What's important to note is that the Eviction Defense Project is unique among legal advice clinics. Most clinics stop at advice and document drafting. The Eviction Defense Project, because we're located in the Milwaukee County Courthouse, also actually includes in-court representation of our clients in a limited scope representation that is limited to that afternoon.
Okay, now, just stop a minute, because that's a little bit of a new concept. So you do totally pro bono, where people come in and they have no money and the lawyer does not appear. And then you do limited scope representation where the lawyer does appear. Are they for folks that can't afford to pay, or are they for people who pay a smaller fee for a lesser representation?
All of Legal Action's clients are low-income, indigent clients subject to our federal regulations. So,
none of our clients pay.
Our services are always free. Okay. And our services incorporate that initial interview with the client, as well as the in-court representation, again, very often on the same day if that client has court that afternoon. So they meet with clients, they review the case, they do a thorough analysis of the case, and then they also engage directly with the opposing party, either the landlord or the landlord's attorney, to negotiate some sort of resolution. And when necessary and appropriate, we argue the case in front of the court commissioner to try to obtain a trial date in front of the court. It is important to note that the Eviction Defense Project volunteers do not contest every single case. We do not send every case to trial, even though we could do it probably far more often than we do. And the reason we do that is because we only raise those issues when supported by the merits and when appropriate. One thing I want to make very clear to the court is that the representation that we provide is beneficial to our clients, obviously, but it also carries numerous benefits for the court. And that's something that we've heard back from the court itself. The presiding court judges, the court commissioners have been unanimous in their positive praise of the project, which is indicative of the improved efficiency that legal representation provides for their services. The court has even referred complicated cases to us. And the reason for that is simple, because we distill complex issues to make it easier and more efficient for the court to function. The lone voice of filed opposition to this petition was the comment submitted by Attorney Vesey, and that made reference to the check-the-box answer that's been discussed already, check-the-box answer that they found offensive. And in that letter, without support or substantiation, alleged that the defense is being raised for specious. With respect to the check-the-box answer, I think the court would agree that it is well within a court's ability to review a document with checkboxes and to identify the ones that are actually checked, to know that those are the only defenses that are being raised, that are being identified as at issue. It's also important to note that with respect to that checkbox answer, that document was created primarily for use in clinics where volunteer attorneys were working without access to printers, without access to computers. So having the available defenses listed for them would allow them to more easily identify the ones that were relevant to that case. As this court knows, all attorneys are subject to ethical obligations. We take an oath to uphold them. And regardless of the scope, there is a difference, an important difference, between a frivolous argument and one that the opposing party simply does not like. It's important to remember that the landlord community in Milwaukee did not have to deal with attorneys raising issues prior to the creation of this project. And an issue like notice, a fact-based inquiry, if there is a dispute over that, that is not inherently frivolous. And under the ethical rules as they exist, attorneys doing limited scope representation are allowed to rely on the representations of their client when developing arguments. So if an attorney hears from their client that a notice was not received, unless they have some reason to believe that the client is lying, then we will identify that as a defense. Just because a client is poor does not mean that they are not entitled to the same level of belief and respect that any other client is entitled to. And I can say with utmost confidence that I am unaware of a single ethical complaint that's been lodged either with OLR or the courts in connection with the abuse of ghostwriting and any of our volunteers at the EDP. I've had similar conversations with the Milwaukee Justice Center and the Marquette Volunteer Legal Clinic, and their experience has been the same. There have been no complaints about abuse of ghostwriting. I think an interesting point about Attorney Giese's comments that he filed is that he included an EDP document. And until today, there was no reference to that EDP document being specious or frivolous. In fact, in the text of his comment, he identifies that document as being an example of an EDP attorney complying with the identification requirements as they currently exist. And of course it does, because that's what our attorneys do. They represent the poor, they represent the indigent, and they do that to the best of their abilities and in full compliance with their legal and ethical obligations. Frankly, the notion that our volunteers are engaging in illegal or unethical behavior without some sort of substantiation is incorrect and offensive. Our volunteers are doing hard work. They're dedicating time and energy to these issues, and they take it very seriously. To the extent that there are any concerns about accountability, I'd like to remind the court that the Eviction Defense Project is unique among clinics because our attorneys are physically there. They are there negotiating with the other side. They are there in front of the court. So as Justice Dellett alluded to earlier, if these issues needed to be raised, there is an ample opportunity for that to happen. And we've simply not seen it. The elimination of ghostwriting was an overreaction to a problem that did not exist. It's an overreaction that was explicitly intended to address hypothetical issues with one project in Milwaukee. And because of that overreaction, we've seen a burden imposed on attorneys providing limited scope representation throughout the state in numerous contexts, pro bono and otherwise. And while the law eliminating ghostwriting may have been well intended by the legislature, it's clear that the legislature should not be the crucible in which these sorts of rules are forged. At the legislative hearing last week on the proposed amendment, Representative Brooks, Senator Olson, both expressed concern about overreach, about unintended implications tied to this rule and the harm it could have to pro bono representation. It's worth noting that the amendment further complicates a situation where, as so eloquently identified in Crowles and Brady's petition, the law chills pro bono participation and the amendment muddies waters by further complicating issues. It creates confusion on the applicability by noting that they are in contested matters without addressing when a contested matter actually exists. It is practically unworkable because it places the burden of identifying the drafting attorney on either, first, the responsibility for identifying the drafting attorney is raised when opposing party requests it. And it is unclear from the amendment whether the burden for that falls on the clerk of courts, turning them into a fact finder, a concern that was expressed very clearly by the clerk of Dane County Courts at the hearing last week, or whether that obligation instead falls on the pro se litigant. If it falls on the pro se litigant, there's then a question of what happens if they are unable to provide that information. And if that is the case, the amendment not only does it chill attorney participation, but it potentially discourages and disincentivizes pro se low-income people from seeking out legal advice, the exact opposite of what the limited scope representation rules were designed to do. Again, the legislature, I'm sure, is well-intentioned in their action, but they simply lack the resources that this court had when it adopted those rules. They lack 3 years of PPAC analysis examining these issues, and they lack a thoughtful and deliberate recommendation on how the court should handle pleadings, practice, and procedural rules. And again, when we look at this court's authority to supersede law by rule, it is with respect to pleadings, practice, and procedural rules, issues which are clearly within this court's jurisdiction. Because of all these reasons, legal action supports this petition, and we urge the court to adopt the recommendations of the petitioner. I welcome any questions from the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Olenichek.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Aaron Olenichek. I am currently serving as the president of the Milwaukee Bar Association, and the Bar Association asked me to appear today in support of Quarles and Brady's petition. While this is clearly a statewide issue, I'd like to briefly touch on the implications to the greater Milwaukee area, which the Milwaukee Bar Association serves. Supreme Court Rule 26.1 states that every lawyer has a professional responsibility to provide legal services to those unable to pay. A lawyer should aspire to render at least 50 hours of pro bono publico legal services per year. The Milwaukee Bar Association has approximately 2,100 members, representing 12% of all attorneys in Wisconsin. Further, Milwaukee is home to over 5,300 attorneys out of a total of approximately 16,800 in the entire state of Wisconsin. This rule disproportionately impacts pro bono services offered in the Milwaukee area. And as a result, it greatly impacts the Milwaukee judicial system for all the reasons that we've heard this morning. Combining this with the fact that funding for civil legal aid in Wisconsin is among the lowest in the country, the importance of encouraging attorneys to volunteer their time and removing barriers to do so is immensely important. There are a number of pro bono organizations that are affected by the chilling effect of this rule change in the Milwaukee area. The most closely related to the Milwaukee Bar Association is the Milwaukee Justice Center and the Mobile Legal Clinic, which are supported by the Milwaukee Bar Foundation. The Milwaukee Justice Center serves over 10,000 people each year that are in need of legal assistance who cannot otherwise access it. The Mobile Legal Clinic served over 700 people in 2019, up from 400 in 2018. The Milwaukee Bar Association believes there should be incentives, not roadblocks, to encouraging participation at these institutions. And indeed, it is part of the Milwaukee Bar Association's mission. Volunteer attorney programs, in particular the Milwaukee Justice Center, ease the burden on courts, acting as a first point of contact to guide people through the court system. And this is particularly the case for family court. But there are many other organizations that also utilize volunteer attorneys, including but not limited to the Marquette Volunteer Legal Clinics, which runs 5 days a week, the Sojourner Family Peace Center, which helps victims of domestic violence, the Lotus Legal Clinic, the 2019 award winner of the NBA's Pro Bono Publico Award, which helps victims of human trafficking, Voices de la Frontera, promoting immigration and workers' rights issues, and of course, the Legal Aid Society and Legal Action of Wisconsin, who we've heard from. The NBA spoke with several of these providers, and it was verified that attorney volunteers that formerly drafted items for clients do not do so because of this rule change. They did not want to be mistaken for attorneys of record, and the negative impact of this is apparent. Due to the lack of volunteers, there are now fewer resources for pro bono representation for low-income litigants and uncertainty for lawyers. The rule, as it is currently written, impacts all of these organizations. It was difficult enough already for these organizations to recruit pro bono volunteers. We should not adopt rules that make volunteering even more difficult and undesirable. The rule, as it is currently written by the legislature, creates a barrier to attorneys volunteering in all of these organizations. This, in turn, leaves individuals wholly unrepresented throughout the legal process, leading to delay and inefficiency in the court system. The Milwaukee Bar Association seeks to promote greater access to justice and to promote judicial efficiency, and therefore respectfully requests that this court restore Wisconsin Statute 802.05 to its previous iteration and allow ghostwriting once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time to come in.
You're welcome.
Attorney Dwyer.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Mike Dwyer. I'm a relatively recently retired circuit judge after spending 22 years on the bench in Milwaukee. I'm here today to talk about two things. The first is to ensure that you do not have the impression that I agree with the so-called compromise proposed by Mr. Giese. The second is to explain why I believe that the issue of ghostwriting is intrinsic to the operation of our court system and why that's important to this rule. With regard to Mr. Giese, I've known him for years. I think of him as a friend. I admire him as a lawyer. I know that he has spent his career diligently and single-mindedly and very effectively protecting the interests of landlords in Milwaukee. Retired Judge Jim Gramley and I thought it would be useful, worth the effort, to meet with him after the statute got passed. What we learned was that the problem that led Mr. Giese and the landlords to propose the legislation was this check-the-box answer form, about which we've heard. We learned in meeting with Mr. Giese that the use of that form had ended shortly after the initiation of the Eviction Defense Project and before the statute was passed. In short, the problem that prompted the statute to be passed had been resolved. Attorney Giese's response is this proposed compromise, and part of the reason I'm here is because in his submission to you, he said it was apparently not acceptable, and I just want to make sure that it is not acceptable. And it's not acceptable, frankly, because it's not necessary. It doesn't solve, there is no problem in existence that it solves. To the extent that I understand the reason for it is this concern about unethical practice. And I think that's been covered adequately. I do think that if there are concerns about unethical practice, there are ways of identifying the lawyers and disciplining them. When we, after we met with Attorney Giese, Jim and I conveyed to him our request that he use his influence in conveying to the legislature that the problems that had provoked the passing of the legislation had been resolved, and asking that he would convey it to his clients, the landlords, and not oppose an effort to restore the statute. Well, he declined to do that, and so here we are today. Now let me explain why I think this proposal actually threatens the independence of the judiciary as an independent third branch of the government. I think we all agree that the court should have final say in matters that are intrinsic to the operation of the court. I know that Mr. Giese in his submission to the court concedes that, and he did so at the legislative hearing.
Mr. Dwyer, are you suggesting that the legislature did not have authority to pass the legislation in the first place?
I do not. No.
If the legislation impinges on our core judicial authority, that would implicate the separation of powers doctrine, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Which would mean they didn't have the authority to implement the legislation in the first place.
Well, although the statute that shares the authority about rulemaking makes the bodies co-equal.
Right. So that would indicate that it's not within our core judicial authority. Let me just put it this way. If we do this as a Venn diagram, our core judicial authority and shared authority are mutually exclusive. There's no overlap between those.
There is no overlap, is what you're saying?
Correct.
All right. Well, I believe that the rules of policy of procedure and pleading are the core of the court and the operation of the court, and that
that would mean that the legislature cannot legislate in that area at all. Then,
And clearly it can. I think I'm back to Mr. Goldsmith's comment earlier that in that contest, where there is shared authority, it's the last party to act. But I take your point. Your point is that if it were not shared and it were exclusive to the judiciary, then the legislature couldn't act. And clearly that's not the case here. What I want to focus on is that the issue of ghostwriting is an aspect of limited scope representation. We have spoken about that. I want to state explicitly that limited scope representation is the most significant tool that we currently have for addressing the needs of litigants, both poor and otherwise, who navigate the court system without lawyers. Meeting the needs of these litigants is essential to providing access to justice to all, which is ultimately the highest purpose of the court system. Now, meeting this challenge was a primary goal of mine as a judge. It has also been a constant goal and effort of this court. Your PPAC identified self-represented litigants as a top priority in each of the five planning cycles from 2004 to 2015. PPAC committed three committees to study the issue, and I was a member of the first two and the chair of the third, and so I guess I would offer myself to you to answer questions about the thought processes and the proceedings that those committees went through. Ghostwriting is just one part of a fairly complicated set of rules and procedures. It's not appropriate now to go through all of those. There's no time for that. But The whole question, the study of limited scope representation started in response to the problem of self-represented litigants flooding our courts, and the puzzle that while limited scope representation has been permitted under the codes of ethics forever, it was not available. Lawyers were not providing the service. And so the committee met, and the first committee basically met to decide, is limited scope representation a good thing? How are states using it? Is it helpful? Surveys were taken of judges throughout the state, and that committee basically came down to the conclusion that limited scope representation is a positive good, and we should promote it. That led to the second committee, which enacted this list of improvements that were passed in 2013 unanimously, and I'm quite sure without opposition. The fundamental fear and the fundamental hindrance to limited scope representation before those rules were passed was a fear by lawyers, if they provided limited scope representation, that they would be recruited into the case on a basis beyond that which they had arranged to be involved.
When you were on the bench, did you have people that were participating and needed representation and were provided pro bono representation that wasn't disclosed?
If it wasn't disclosed, I probably wouldn't.
Well, sometimes, yeah, that's right. That's a silly question.
Actually, that's not really true. We said on the committee that
right.
If you can't tell,
that a document has been drafted by a lawyer, it's probably not a very good document. I mean, typically, you can tell. And certainly, in the early stages of my career, limited scope representation just wasn't done.
There, right.
Right, which was the reason for the committee, which was the reason for the rule. Now, two rules that are part of this that I think are relevant. One of them is the rule that a limited scope lawyer need not do a independent investigation of the facts represented by the pro se litigant. That lawyer can accept the representations of the lawyer unless the lawyer has reason to know that they are false. And it was precisely to address this, the problem, insoluble, of doing investigation of a claimed service error, sitting at a desk with a hearing in the next room in the next 10 minutes. The other rule was the conflicts of interest. I'll call it a waiver. It isn't actually a waiver, but clearly limited scope representation has benefits to both parties who can pay a fee and to parties who cannot. But I think it's fair to say that the most urgent aspect of the population are those who can't afford legal representation and who navigate the courts in, you know, huge numbers without any help at all. So in order to promote pro bono representation, the requirement that a lawyer I can't cite all of the qualifications, but it's a court-connected pro bono program. Those lawyers need not do conflicts checks unless they know that there's a conflict.
Well, if they know, they wouldn't be doing a check, though, right?
Right. In other words, these questions were contemplated. And from my perspective, and from, I think, the people who are here, the large firms in Milwaukee have lawyers who are available to do pro bono work, who are looking for opportunities to do so. And those rules, as part of that whole package, were designed to promote their participation. Justice Bradley, your question about knowing who the other side is and taking a position that's contrary to, an existing client, law firms do that all the time. It's not like lawyers only represent one position, and so that they only have clients who promote that, and so that having that disclosure, while it may chill the big firm's willingness to participate, it really doesn't give anything to the litigant, except, I suppose, to complain to the firm, which gets us right back around to the chilling effect of the requirement of disclosure.
Well, I suppose if the client is really concerned about whether its firm is providing these types of services on the other side, the client could just ask.
Right. And certainly Quarles & Grady is not shy about touting its very admirable pro bono work. And as Mr. Olenichuk points out, we have an ethical obligation to do pro bono work. So I do believe it's important to focus on what the purpose of disclosure is. The purpose is to prevent the unethical practice of law, as I think is what it comes down to here. And I can say in 22 years of experience on the bench, I have never personally experienced a complaint that a ghost-written document was the result of unethical practice. Other than Mr. Giese's and the landlord's complaint about the Eviction Defense Project which problem has been resolved, I'm not aware of any other complaints, and others have indicated the same experience. In fact, I think that courts in general are very happy to be spared the often rambling and sometimes unintelligible documents that are submitted by self-represented litigants, and that ghost writing is a benefit to the court. My ultimate point to you is that carving out this one topic of ghostwriting among the 7 or 8 issues that were covered by the limited scope representation rules which was the court's systematic response to the tremendously challenging and important question of self-represented litigants is a perfect example of an issue that is intrinsic to the operation of the court as a co-equal branch of government with authority over the administration of justice and the management of pleading and practice. So I want to close with a comment that I think illustrates why this issue is intrinsic to the administration of justice and one that the court should act upon. Not granting the petition leaves us with significant confusion in that the statute that's the subject of the rule conflicts with the rules for appellate procedures and some ethical rules for lawyers. Would the court look to the legislature to resolve those conflicts? Who would be appropriate to resolve those conflicts? It seems clear to me that it is the court, and that the conclusion is that the court should approve this petition.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Giving us your thoughts on all of this. The last attorney I have on my list is Attorney Motz.
Good morning, and thank you for having me here today. My name is Kyla Motz, and I'm the legal director of the Milwaukee Justice Center, which we've heard a bit about this morning. The Milwaukee Justice Center sees over 10,000 pro se litigants in a year, and we also have hundreds of volunteers in our clinics. We are the largest provider of pro se services in Milwaukee County. I personally spend over 25 hours per week supervising clinics that assist pro se litigants in things from filling out standardized forms, and also I supervise several of our brief legal advice clinics. And so I'm here today to express the Milwaukee Justice Center's support of the petition and also to give you some information about how the change in the ghostwriting rule has impacted our operations. And I should note that the Milwaukee Justice Center works primarily in the area of family law, so although this amendment was intended to, I think, deal with landlord-tenant issues, it has had major impacts across various practice areas, not just in the area where it was intended. It is this amendment to the ghostwriting statute has severely reduced attorney participation in our legal advice clinics. Some attorneys have told us explicitly that they're no longer going to come because of ghostwriting. Others have merely stopped volunteering. They have ghosted us, if you'll allow me that pun. and that sudden drop-off in volunteers came sort of directly after we had the change in the ghostwriting rules and a CLE that followed that. And so I think that it's a fairly logical assumption to assume that it was related to that. I know earlier we had a question about numbers. I can give you some general numbers. In our family law clinics, we have one every day, so an average of 20 in a month, roughly. It can be more or less. And prior to the ghostwriting statute, we could cover that with no attorneys pulling double shifts, so we had at least 20 to 30 volunteers in a month. Now, since the change in that, I have 3 to 5 volunteers who cover half of my clinics, so we are incredibly dependent on a very small group of attorneys. And I know one concern we have is that core group of attorneys, that depending on 3 to 5 people to cover 15 shifts in a month just isn't a sustainable practice. So we probably have 10 to 15 attorneys total in our family law clinic now, as opposed to that 20 to 30 from before. We, as a result of sort of this, we've also had to essentially eliminate attorney participation in our family forms clinic because there is so much confusion about at what point you're actually giving advice, because that clinic, attorneys don't give advice. They just assist in filling out the standardized forms. And there's a lot of confusion about, well, if I told somebody this is what a substantive change in circumstances is, or this is what it means by this, have I crossed into that advice line? And so most attorneys won't participate in that clinic anymore. So it's staffed primarily by students at this point. And the effect for pro se litigants has been that we have fewer opportunities to help them. We have had numerous people who will come in 2 or 3 or 4 days and still not be able to be seen because the number of slots we have available for them to be seen are so limited. I would also note that we have seen attorneys in our clinics be less willing to assist in drafting documents and in completing standardized forms, as I mentioned, because one of the main fears that I have heard is listing their name and bar number will lead to the belief that they continue to represent the person in an ongoing basis. And I will just note that I am sympathetic for that. Through the MJC, I notarize a large number of documents, so I don't indicate drafted with the assistance of attorney, literally just notarizing a form that needs to be notarized. And I would say I receive one or two calls a month from someone who believes that because I notarized the document, I represent that client. And so I have to imagine that including a state, including my bar number and my name written more clearly than my signature, and a statement that said I helped with the document would only increase that confusion tenfold. I would also just note that the suggested change that we've heard about, we don't think necessarily would help resolve the issues we're seeing, because family law by its nature is almost always contested. Obviously, in divorce cases, they're contested, and usually in sort of the paternity and post-judgment modification ones that we're seeing, we see that as well. And so if it is the idea of a fair and equitable justice system is important, we think that it's paramount that all sides of a case have access to resources to advise them and place them in the best position possible. And we think that the ghostwriting amendment has really limited us in our pursuit of that goal. And so therefore, we would support the petition.
Good. Thank you very much. Well, I noticed after I got my list, two other people had signed up, Attorney Rapp. And then I'm going to ask if there's anybody here that hasn't seen the marshal beforehand to be added to the list, and then I'll get back to you again, Attorney Goldschmidt, at the end. I beg your pardon. Yes, I know. I have two more people. Right. Thank you. Please.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Rebecca Rapp. I'm General Counsel of Ascendium Education Group, and I'm here to urge you to restore your 2014 ghostwriting rule. Ascendium is the nation's largest federal student loan guarantor. It is also one of the nation's largest higher education philanthropies. Ascendium's legal team has worked on two limited scope clinics. About 5 years ago, we started a clinic at Vera Court Neighborhood Center here on Madison's north side. We see clients one morning a month. We have served over 100 people. Clients come with a range of issues, but by far the biggest is family law. Last year, we started work on a second project, limited scope clinics at technical colleges in Madison and Milwaukee. The clinics are staffed by a whole host of local legal service providers. They help people address legal issues that could keep them from attending school or pursuing certain career paths. We have served well over 100 clients at Madison College Clinic since its soft launch in September. By the way, we're having an open house in February that I will invite you all to, and I hope you attend. Ascendium is currently working to expand to other technical colleges, including in Wisconsin's rural areas, which have been labeled a legal desert. The ghostwriting rule was fundamental to the development of both clinics. I was familiar with the rule because I'd been on judicial counsel during the period of extensive study that preceded its adoption. I'd been impressed during the discussions about how a ghostwriting rule could make it easier for attorneys to help people. I was excited to take advantage of the rule when Ascendium started its pro bono program, for all the reasons the rule garnered support initially. Ascendium's legal team is small, and we're not set up to take lengthy or protracted matters. We cannot risk clients or courts being confused about our ongoing involvement. Further, though we are committed to and bound by legal ethics rules, there's concern about being permanently tied to documents given the limited factual or conflict investigation that occurs in a limited scope engagement and our inability to control what clients do with documents after we help them. The ghostwriting rule alleviated these concerns. It allowed us to help people more effectively and efficiently by letting us complete court forms and prepare other pleadings for clients as opposed to just providing more general advice. This is particularly important given the limited amount of time we have with clients and the language and other barriers many clients face. I've talked with a lot of other attorneys trying to recruit them to pro bono activities, including some at other companies here in Madison and elsewhere. They have expressed similar concerns about volunteering. I also want to note, to address some of Justice Bradley's questions, attorneys don't view this not having to give your name as a free pass in terms of conflict rules. I think the attorneys with whom I've spoken take their duty of loyalty towards their existing clients very seriously. And a lot of times what they'll do is they'll think about what programs they want to get involved in, be it an eviction clinic or a Wills for Heroes clinic or something else, and determine where their attorneys will get involved based on those sort of existing duties of loyalties that they have. Being able to do pro bono work is particularly important for me, not just because of my pro bono involvement at Ascendium, but also because of what I saw before coming to Ascendium about how critical legal representation can be for people. Earlier in my career, I represented children and guardians in abuse, neglect, and special education proceedings as an attorney at the Children's Law Center in Washington, D.C. Our work often made the difference between children receiving good homes and educations and not. I also witnessed the importance of legal help in a stint as a circuit court judge here in Dane County. The cost of the justice gap by far falls the heaviest on unrepresented people, and the impact on courts has been discussed in a variety of reports, including Wisconsin's own 2007 justice gap study. I want to conclude, however, by addressing another less discussed interest, the business communities. Industry groups have decried the justice gaps on the grounds that it harms the communities where businesses are located and the legal system on which businesses rely. These are important points, but there are two other business interests I want to mention. First, the cost of pro se litigation. Responding to pro se litigation can be quite costly, often more so than cases against the brightest and best of attorneys. The sort of helping attorneys, clients winnow out meritorious claims and think realistically about whether their high emotions are really claims that some other attorneys eloquently spoke of, I think would be of great value to businesses to have people thinking about litigation have that kind of help beforehand. Pro se pleadings are often difficult to construe and are followed by a bevy of amendments and motions. It is also often difficult to engage self-represented litigants in settlement or other discovery discussions aimed at more effectively administering or ending cases. The second interest I want to talk about is the labor shortage. Unemployment numbers are unprecedentedly low, and Wisconsin businesses are having considerable difficulty filling positions. If someone could not work because they had a broken jaw or a respiratory condition, we would get them medical treatment they needed so they could resume work, among other things. Legal issues can present just as large of barriers. Indeed, the broken jaw could be the result of domestic violence, the respiratory condition due to mold. In each of these instances, legal help could address not just the symptoms, but truly the underlying conditions. Expanding access to justice, in turn, provides a way for businesses not just to draw from the same depleted labor pool or to cycle through employees and to repeatedly incur onboarding expenses, but to actually expand the labor pool and to provide people the help they need to share their talents and expertise. This point is underscored by the tremendous response the Madison College Clinic has already had. The justice gap in Wisconsin is huge. It significantly impedes people's ability to pursue their legal rights and everything, family, home, health, and safety, legal rights protect. This court took an important step to reduce the justice gap with the ghostwriting rule. Given the justice gap and what's at stake for litigants, courts, and businesses, I urge you to restore the rule. Thank you for your consideration.
Yes, thank you very much for coming. Okay. I bet you thought I was going to forget you sitting back there, right?
I'm hard to miss. No, thank you, Chief Justice.
Attorney Hoff.
I am Attorney Dan Hoff. I also apologize. I must have gotten the same cold from the Northland that Diedrich did as well. I'm Attorney Dan Hoff from Appleton, Wisconsin. We also have an office in Shawano. I bring that up for a reason. But more importantly, I am, as most of you understand, the State Access to Justice Chairman and President of that organization. It is our mission to make sure that we try to promote the access to civil legal justice. We have 18 members to our commission, and I have the good fortune of being able to address you once a year, and generally in April or May, depending on the year. Now, what we've heard today, I'm not going to do, is I'm not going to reiterate the fine people that you've listened to today that are the boots on the ground that are out there doing the hard work. We're here to promote that as Access to Justice Commission. The use of the ghostwriting petition and the limited scope rules are essential to the expansion to allow the access to justice. I have been a practicing lawyer in this state as a family law practitioner and a civil lawyer in litigation for coming up on 32 years when I was sworn in this wonderful chamber in May. I have also had the opportunity to deal directly with one of the questions that Justice Bradley raised. I have also worked not only in my capacity as the president of the Access to Justice. I've done pro bono work, like many of my folks that and colleagues in my area. But I've also worked at the number of increasing number of clinics that have opened up. We have one in Outagamie County. It is important, not only to the access to justice, but folks, to the efficiency of the court system. We all know that when we have proper legal documents, when we have people who are at least well-educated enough to know how to properly deal with this is why we've raised certain other rules petitions, that the efficiency of justice is much better. And not only is the efficiency of justice much better, but the access to justice is better. And then people in the community also have that feeling that the justice system is working for them. It's an important factor. But as I was indicating, I have worked in one of those clinics. I have, in fact, because of the limited scope, had the ability to meet with people. But when everybody who works in those clinics that I know of takes their job extremely seriously. There is no difference between a paying or a non-paying client. So when we sit down with one of these folks, we ask a certain level of questions first, as we would in our own office, to try and weed out conflicts. I have found a conflict while sitting there and immediately backed away because you never got into the middle of the necessity. The limited scope, however, is necessary. And all I can say is, you heard it from the people that are there, that are out on the grounds, not just in Milwaukee, but all of the 72 counties in this state. These people need every tool they can to get as much pro bono help as possible because this state does not have enough funding for civil legal access to justice. We encourage you and for the promotion of this petition that has been filed by Qualls and Brady. Thank you very much for their fine work. We ask the court accept that petition and listen very carefully as we've had from these fine folks who do their hard work. If there's any questions, I would be more than happy to do so. I note that we did file previously a letter on November 14 of 2019. You know, you give a mic to a litigator and a Norwegian, and we could go on all day, but I am cleanup, and I'm not going to do that. You get to hear from me again in a couple of months.
Thank you for your time, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, is there anybody else whose name I haven't called who would like to speak on this petition before I have Attorney Goldschmidt come back? Okay, there are no takers, so I guess you have the last shot at it.
That's understandable. That was a tough act to follow. Just a few brief points in closing. First, as I listened to everything stated today and review all the comments submitted in support of this petition, I'm left with the same impression that I had at the beginning of this matter, which is that it is astonishing to me that so small and unsubstantiated a grievance in a small corner of small claims court could lead to such a drastic change in the law with statewide consequences, despite all of the careful study given to this issue by this court. And what that leaves me feeling is it's a good thing this court is here to do something about it. Second, I want to make sure that we don't leave Justice Kelly or anyone else with any misimpressions about the separation of powers. This court clearly has authority to act in this matter. That authority is conferred by statute 751.12. And in 1931, in the rules of court case 204 WIS 501, this court considered the constitutionality of that statute as previously numbered when it was enacted. And
I have no concerns about our ability to pass rules in this realm. I want to make sure that we understand that the legislature does as well.
Yes, we do agree with that, and the discussion in the rules of court case is actually quite interesting on that point. The authority that the court is being asked to exercise here is its rulemaking authority, which actually has been delegated by the legislature through statute. The legislature has the power to make the law. Ordinarily, this court says what the law is, but the legislature has delegated some of that rulemaking authority to this court, and the question in the rules of court case was that delegation constitutional? This court concluded that it was, because if you go back to the founding of the country and even the English common law, it is clear that the ability to make rules of procedure affecting the court and its work has always been associated with the court system, and for that reason, it was not unconstitutional for the legislature to delegate that particular rulemaking authority to this court. Third, I want to return just briefly to Justice Bradley's question about this desire to know who's on the other side in a contested case. I think it's natural, but I would ask the follow-up question, to what end? What legitimate purpose does it serve to know that information? If there is a frivolous pleading or unethical conduct, I think we've covered how the courts can address that in a particular case, even without this attorney identification rule. Otherwise, the only interest that I've heard on that side of the balance is that clients may wish to know if someone is adverse to them from their own law firm. And I think that is an understandable desire. But if the implication is that we want clients to know that so that they can stop giving business to firms that are going to be adverse to them in pro bono work, then I think Justice Ziegler stated the point succinctly, there goes all the firm support for pro bono work. And that can't be an outcome that this court supports. Finally, we understand the court may be hesitant to act while the legislature is on some level considering this issue. We urge you to proceed. Our best sense of the legislative rumblings is that they will die down if this court takes definitive action today. My conversation with Representative Brooks confirmed that he wants to fix the problem if this court does not. I'm glad that we have that opportunity if we need it, but I hope we don't need it. We came to this court because it is the author of the ghostwriting rule in the first instance. It is best situated to understand the needs of the courts that it supervises and to regulate the conduct of the attorneys practicing law in those courts. If this court nevertheless elects not to act today, then at a minimum, we would ask that you suspend the current rule until whatever process that needs to play out has played out. At least then, at a minimum, the harm that is being worked by the current rule will not continue for any longer.
What process would you, are you referring to playing out?
I hope there is no more process to play out because this court will act today and that will be the end of the matter.
Right. But you suggested that perhaps if we're not willing to do that, we should suspend the rule while a process plays out. What would that process be?
That was based on an assumption that this court may have a desire to see what happens next in the legislature. And I don't presume to know what the court thinks on that count, but I want to address it just in case. But for all the reasons that you have heard today, I beseech you, please, grant this petition and grant it today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for all the work that you've done on this. I know it's quite an undertaking, and the court appreciates very much. And the thanks of the court to all of you who came to speak. Dean Dietrich, you are a real regular here, as are some other people, and you would think you live next door, but you don't. So thank you very much, all of you. A number of you have come from quite a distance, and you really do help the court out by coming and letting us know what's going on around the state. So we appreciate it very much, whether you're in favor of it or opposed to it. It's good for us to hear all positions, and we will so consider them. The court is going to adjourn now on rule petition 1916, and we will meet in closed conference at 12:20. We are adjourned.